Hebrews 1, verses 1 to 4. Let us hear the word of the Lord. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in the last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. He provided the purification of sins. He sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. So he became as much superior to the angels as the name he had inherited is superior to theirs. God bless us with the understanding of his word. Amen.
And the lights can come back on. We're going to discuss meaning today. Is there anyone behind the curtain? Is there anyone running the show? You know, for most of my university career, I've spent studying texts. You know, either in particular biblical texts, but I've taken uni-level philosophy, theology, history, English, and I've studied all sorts of texts, written documents. And as I began my study, I gradually came to confront a most extraordinary fact. Many literary critics and philosophers were profoundly skeptical about the very notion of author intention. That is, they doubted that authors could place meanings in texts which could be identified by readers. I kept hearing about the death of the author. I was told the only meaning to be found in a text was the meaning that the reader brings to it. And while I was reading this from the critics, I wasn't getting it much from my professors, though, because I studied at a big Christian liberal arts university, and my professors tended to disagree with the skepticism of many of their secular peers. And to be honest, I shared the skepticism of my professors. The whole idea that we should deny that there's any objective meaning in texts seemed not only wrong, it was just seemed downright preposterous to me. And for those literary critics busily writing essays to undermine the notion that there was authorial meaning to be found in the text, it seemed that it was self-refuting as well. As the philosopher John Searle pointed out, these critics who were writing this stuff deeply resented it when people misread their texts. And so I didn't have all the problems with this skeptical literary criticism sorted into my mind. I couldn't answer all their objections, but I knew enough to be deeply suspicious. I was unapologetic about denying the primacy of authorial intention in the text. There was objective meaning to be found in the text, I thought. It wasn't always easy to be found, but hard work would be rewarded with increased understanding, I thought. And so I kept reading texts, the Bible, books, everything, articles, newspapers, what have you, blogs, even Twitter updates, with a commitment to their objective meaning and the drive of finding that meaning. What was the author? What was the person who said this? What were they actually trying to convey? To deny the presence of objective meaning seemed absurd to me. And so instead, I rejected the skeptics. And I want to argue that our lives are like texts, in the same way that the reader searches for an objective meaning, a meaning that no matter what other people think, that meaning exists. I wanted to look for an objective meaning and an authorial intention in the words written on the page. And so in the same way, we naturally search for meaning in our own lives. And so just as there are skeptics who declare the death of the author and who claim that the only meaning to be found in text is the meaning we bring to them, so there are those who proclaim the death of the author behind the text of our lives and who claim that the only meaning in our lives is the meaning we bring to them. Have you ever heard this before? What makes you happy? Find your own meaning in your life, right? Do what you want to do as long as you hurt no one else. This is the mantra of our culture. And so we can ask, for example, is Winnie the Pooh, do you have Winnie the Pooh here? Yeah. Is Winnie the Pooh a post, I don't know, something's, anyway. Winnie the Pooh is named after a city in Canada, Winnipeg, which is pretty cool. Anyway, is Winnie the Pooh a post-existentialist exploration of the deconstructed homoeroticism of youth? It is if you want it to be, or so says the reader who thinks he's at liberty to create his own meanings. No! Winnie the Pooh has nothing to do with the morbid imagination of some wayward graduate student. The author has not been lost, and he is not dead. He is to be found in the text, if we only have the time and care to read and listen. And so in the same way that some people think they can make of a text whatever they want, so some think they can make of life whatever they want. They claim that the only meaning is to be found in a life is the meaning the one living the life brings to it. The story we find ourselves in is the beginning and end of the meaning and purpose of life. That's what we're going to discuss. But I think this is wrong. Objective meaning exists as surely within the text of our lives as it exists in the texts of our libraries. And just as our successful engagement with a literary text depends on our getting at that meaning, you know, every week I come up here, I pick a Bible text and we discuss the meaning of that text most of the time. So it's the same way with our lives. Let's take this Zoolander thing as an example, okay? The reason why I bring up the Zoolander thing is because they're doing what makes them happy, right? You know, they go to a gas station, they're dancing around, catchy music, they're throwing water at each other, then they bring in some gasoline or petrol, right? You know, and right? They're doing what makes them happy. They're happy in that video. Agree? Who here disagrees that they were not happy? They were happy. They were having a great time. But unfortunately, human beings and petrol and lighter fluid don't work together. Doesn't matter how happy it makes you. Doesn't matter how much you love putting petrol all over your body and lighting flames. The human condition, that's not our meaning in life. That's not our purpose. We're not meant to do that. And so what I want to ask you and what I want us to wrestle with is, do you ever wonder if anyone or anything really runs this whole show? Is there any meaning in our lives? Is there someone pulling the strings, so to speak? And as you peer into your own life, as you wonder if this, if there's this show, is there someone running this thing? Wrestling with, well, you know what? I don't know. Has your hope that someone is really in charge of this creation? Question that. You know, you see the evil in the world. You see churches doing dumb things. You look at the history of the church, and you're like, you know, it's involved in horrible conflicts. You got preachers who give sentimental drivel sometimes. You got, you know, church is boring. The people have weapons, and they use them to hurt other people. And you just wonder, is there anyone really running this show? And if you're wondering that, if you're wrestling with that, you are in very good company. Because you see, the letter to the Hebrews is written to such an exhausted, discouraged, cynical congregation. A congregation who is losing faith that someone is actually running the show. And they want to abandon the Christian faith. They just think this whole thing is starting to go nowhere. We don't know where they're located. We don't know who writes to them. But we do know they're stumbling on their last legs. They're tired. They're losing members by the ton. And for many of them, the Christian faith has turned out to be at best a wild superstition or at worst a vile hoax. They're giving up, drifting away, and trying something else because they really are questioning, is someone running this show? And do you know what this writer says to this discouraged and straying congregation? He describes a heavy dose of what we might call high Christology. He recommends the study of Christ. And this writer doesn't beat around the bush. He doesn't seduce us with programs or cliches or the promise of health and wealth. He tells us what makes Jesus the Christ. He delivers a straightforward testimony, invoking an awesome presence. A presence living within us. A presence with us in depth. A presence who suffers and struggles and fails and triumphs and braves and endures with us all the perils that we share. A presence bearing in and radiating through a person the very assurance of what we hope for, the essence and conviction of things we cannot see. Does this preacher proclaim this? He asserts that long ago, God spoke to our ancestors in many and various ways by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by a son. I mean, what is our meaning in life? In the past, God spoke to us in fragments. God spoke to us in different fashions and styles and moods. It might be through someone like Elijah compelling us to make choices in our loyalties, or Amos turning us to social justice, or Hosea describing one who bends towards us as a loving husband. But in the last days, says God, he speaks to us through his son, a child, a human being like you and me. And in this person, we encounter the ultimate, the final word sent, spoken, revealed. Through this human being, this fellow pilgrim, we see the presence of the divine life packaged in flesh and blood. Through this son, this divine child, we find ourselves encountered, challenged, and embraced to the core of the heart, the mind, and the soul. Relating, concluding, perfect word, not simply spoken, but now incarnate, now human. And what might this incarnate presence mean to us? He explains, Jesus as Christ is the heir of all things. What a confession. Our author answers our most important questions. Where are things headed? What does life mean? Are we just a blob of protoplasm, an itch on the body of this doomed planet? Are we a speck of dust on a speck of dust in a cloud of dust that will eventually just... Or more bluntly, does the one who ends up with the most toys or the most weapons win? Do the rich get richer, the violent carry the day? Do the political spinmeisters, the PR flakes, and the Budweiser apologists define the criteria for truth? Do you have Budweiser here? What's the beer here? The most famous New Zealand beer. Do they just... in North America, if you watch the Super Bowl, the beer commercials are always the best commercials. And sorry. Sorry. Cynicism can be difficult, but our preacher will not surrender to this cynicism. Jesus is the answer, but what does he say our function, our meaning is here on this earth? I want us to look at three passages. And if you'll notice in your notes, along with me in the notes, if we turn to Matthew 22, 37 to 39. Jesus is very, you know, sometimes people ask me, Mark, what is my purpose in life? What should I do? You know, as if there's some secret will that God has for your life that you have to try to figure out. And if you don't figure it out, God goes, ha-ha, zap, right? As if he's trying to mess with you. No, God has clearly established your purpose in life. He has clearly established what you're here for. Now, it's up to you how you want to enact that purpose, but he's laid it pretty clear. So let's look at some of these passages here. Matthew 22, 37 to 39. Okay, Matthew 22, 37 to 39. So Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. And then our next passage, Matthew 25, 30-46. The Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him. He will sit on his glorious throne. Matthew 25, 31-46. And all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. And then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father. Take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. And I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. And then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or in needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? And the king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. And then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me. And they also will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and did not help you? And he will reply, truly, I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. And then they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. And then in Matthew 28:16-20, very famous. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And then Jesus came to them and said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you to the very end of the age. And so Jesus clearly points out our meaning, the meaning of all humanity, is to love the Lord our God, to love our neighbor as we love ourselves, to help the needy, to help those in need, and to go out and make disciples. And on a side note, every once in a while I meet someone who says something like, I don't think you have to go around telling people about Jesus. I think all you have to do is live the life that Jesus wants you to live so others can see that life and want to become Christians themselves. Have you heard that before? Right? You know, live such a good life so that you don't even have to use words to explain the gospel. Sometimes wonder, doesn't that seem like a very arrogant statement? I mean, stop to think about it. These persons are saying, I don't have to explain Jesus to anybody. I'm so righteous that all I have to do is let people take a good look at me and they will fall over converted. But I don't know about you, but there are enough flaws and shortcomings in my life for me to not want people to look too closely, lest they be disillusioned in a big way. Truthfully, I don't preach myself. I preach Christ. I do not hold myself up because that would be a disaster. I hold Christ up. I have to tell people about Jesus because only he embodies the goodness that is worthy of emulation. All the rest of us fall short of the glory of God. It is through hearing the gospel story that others gain the opportunity to enter into a transforming relationship with God. And I mean, it's great. We need to help people. We need to do, help and meet needs, because otherwise often people can't hear the gospel when they have a hungry stomach. But we need to also point out and emphasize that we need to go out and make disciples. This is our purpose. This is why we are here. This is why God has called us to what he's called us to. But maybe you're thinking, wait a minute, Pastor. Your restrictions on my life. I'm not going to be dumb like Zoolander's friends. I'm going to choose a good meaning, Pastor. Pastor, your way of life is boring, lame, controlling, manipulative, guilt-producing, money-sucking, war-causing, soul-crushing. Did I mention it was boring? You know, I get that last one a lot, actually. Especially people my age, constantly. All the time, Mark, it's so boring, right? And it just boggles my mind because it's so very not boring. It's if you really dig into it, but it just, anyway, that's another sermon. And it was actually, though, when I was younger, my excuse for not wanting to go to church. My parents wanted me to go. I hated it. My brother hated church. He was antagonistic, and I thought it was just, I wasn't against it. It was just so boring. I get that, but again, another sermon. But, you know, some people, as you see in the quotes here, some people think Christianity traps you and stifles your creativity. A woman named Emma Goldman called Christianity the leveler of the human race, the breaker of man's will to dare and to do, an iron net, a straitjacket which does not let him expand or grow. You know, and most people today think that freedom is just everything that you make up for yourself. In the movie I, Robot, Sonny says, now that I fulfill my purpose, I don't know what to do. This robot guy and Detective Spooner, Will Smith, says, I guess you'll have to find your way like the rest of us, Sonny. That's what it means to be free. The idea to be free is that there are no restrictions, that there's no God telling you what to do, that there's no purpose. It's just whatever you do. It's whatever makes you happy. Unfortunately, these views of freedom imply that there's no overriding purpose. For example, there's a great danger when you can just make anything mean anything you want. Imagine rugby. Imagine the Rugby World Cup against France. final game. You know, you won that 8-7, right? Well, what if at some point near the end of the game and France is on, I don't know, what do you call it? Do you say like 50-yard line or 50-meter line? What do you say in rugby? What are those? Do you have lines? Let's just say they're in the middle of the field and the French captain takes the rugby ball, puts him down and says, try. We get 10 points. Which I know isn't the real score for a try. But let's say they just did that. And then everyone was just like, yeah. The whole world was like, yeah. Sucks to be you, New Zealand. Thing would fall apart. The whole point, the whole reason rugby is so interesting is because there's rules, right? You can't just go bring out a shotgun, blow the French captain away, and take the ball away from him. It's not the game of rugby anymore, right? As much fun as that may would have been. So if there's a purpose, then there has to be some constraints. Or, you know, sometimes people are like, you know, churches are really exclusive. You know, they believe certain things, and if you don't believe certain things, you shouldn't be in the church. You know, I don't want to go to a place that's so exclusive, but let's just do a thought experiment. Let's have two organizations, okay? I'll use this. This is really big in the news in the States, you know, same-sex marriage. And let's say you had one group that was like, you know what? Same-sex marriage all the way. Let's do that. This is great. That's the group. That's their goal. Then you have this other group that's like, you know what? Same-sex marriage, don't want to do that. Now, let's say the president of the yay same-sex marriage group goes, you know what? I agree now. I've changed my mind. I had an epiphany. I don't want to support same-sex marriage anymore. And at the same time, the president of the against same-sex marriage group goes, you know what? I've been wrong. I don't think we should be against same-sex marriage anymore. We should be for it. You know what's interesting? That while most people would view the group that is against same-sex marriage as the closed-minded, bigoted, exclusive one, and that the pro-same-sex marriage group would be like, yeah, that's a great freedom-seeking movement, you know, both groups would have to fire their presidents, right? Because if the president of the same-sex marriage pro group was like, I don't believe in this anymore, well, you can't be the president of that group anymore. And if the president of the against it was like, yay, I'm for it, he couldn't be the president. Both groups are exclusive. Any group is exclusive. Any get-together is exclusive. Why? Because there's a purpose behind that group. And whenever there's purpose, there has to be certain boundaries. Often people think Christianity is this straitjacket, this cultural straitjacket, forcing people, I'm on the next page here, people from diverse cultures into a single iron mold. How often do you hear this, that Christianity just oppresses and crushes people, destroys our freedom? But ironically, Christianity has been more adaptive to diverse cultures. Islam is still centered in its place of origin, the Middle East. Hinduism, Buddhism are still at their original centers. Confucianism hasn't penetrated little outside the Far East. But as you notice with Christianity, first it was dominated by Jews in Jerusalem, then by the Hellenists in the Mediterranean, then by barbarians of Northern Europe, then it moved to North America. Now most Christians today live in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. There's beginning to be explosive growth in China. And in Africa, in the 1900s, it was only 9% Christian, and now it's 44%, now having surpassed the Muslims. Christianity is adaptive. It moves around. It embraces culture. It encourages the freedom of culture. Interesting is the only way you can find true freedom is when you limit yourself. For example, to be a great musician, you have to give up certain things, right? You have to restrict your freedom. You have to practice for 8 hours a day. You have to not go out and, if you're a singer, you can't go out and binge drink every single night and smoke and do drugs and all, because you'll affect your singing voice. It happens to the famous singers. They have to take breaks. If you don't restrict yourself, if you don't practice every day, all the time, you will never be that great singer that you strive to be. How many of us wish we were in excellent shape? Right? I wish I had the freedom to be buff. Well, you do. But you don't restrain yourself. You don't restrict yourself. See, the key to true freedom is the restriction. The key to true freedom is living within your purpose. I want to conclude with this because I'm running a little late here. We have purpose. God has clearly established that. He's clearly shown us our purpose. We can't just make up what we want to do with our lives. If we do that, we become like Zoolander. And now Christians do an excellent job of being good Samaritans. Now, well, how do we apply this? We do a good job of being good Samaritans. Whenever the social system grinds out the casualties, the church is more than ready to pick up those casualties, patch up their wounds, and send them back to their place in the system once again. But it does very little to try to change the system itself, which is sad. The story of the Good Samaritan describes a good man who rescues someone who, while traveling on the road between Jericho and Jerusalem, falls among thieves. And we all know the story of how the man is battered and beaten and left for dead, and how the Good Samaritan comes and picks him up and cleans him and his wounds and takes him to a place where he can be cared for and nurtured back to health. It's a moving story and inspires us all to do good works. But the thing we must keep in mind is that while the Good Samaritan did the right thing when he picked up the bandit's victim, keep in mind is if every day two or three people get mugged on the road between Jerusalem and Jericho, there comes at a point at which we must realize that being good Samaritans is not enough. At some point, if such crimes abound, we have to figure out how to put up a better lighting system on the road and perhaps have it patrolled by police and put an end to people being mugged on that dangerous highway. In short, it's one thing to care for the casualties from the system, but sooner or later, we have to change the system so as not to have so many casualties in the first place. It said that the church is God's ambulance squad. We're good at that sort of thing. But sooner or later, we have to do more than just help those who fall victim to the abuses of the unjust and oppressive society. Sooner or later, there comes a point at which the call of God is to change the system itself. And that's why we're having this fundraiser for the Tiny Toons. Because what they want to do is they want to actually help change the society of Cambodia. They want to educate the children. They want to help the children in such a way so that the society of Cambodia changes. They don't want to just give a man a fish. They want to teach a man a fish. And so I encourage you that as Christians, we are called not just to help do one little good work here or one little good work there. We're called to make disciples. We're called to change society in a good way, to bring light to where there is darkness. And so if that's something you're wanting to maybe start to get on, come tonight or talk to Glenda and help us fundraise for this Tiny Toons initiative. I encourage you, if there's other opportunities that you saw here to help out in our community of Auckland, to do that. Because you do have a meaning. You do have a purpose. Some of us are settled to just be happy like Zoolander's friends. But I tell you, that path leads very badly. Lord God, just thank you for today. Thank you that you have clearly stated your purpose for us, Lord, that you've clearly told us what you want us to do while we are still here on this earth, Lord. And I just pray that we would take as Christians that seriously, that we would love you, that we would love our neighbor, that we would help those in need, Lord, and that we would go out and make disciples, Lord. And I just thank you that you've given our church so many opportunities to serve you and to enact your purpose for us, Lord. And I just pray that we would be a church that desires to live our purpose, Lord, and that we wouldn't take the path that leads to destruction. So I just thank you for your gospel. I thank you for your grace. Pray this in your heavenly name. Amen. And